I'm Jay Farner, CEO of Quicken Loans, America's premier home purchase lender. We've created a new way to protect you from unpredictable interest rates. Our exclusive Rate Shield approval. First, we lock your interest rate for up to 90 days. Then, if rates go up, your rate stays locked. But if rates go down, your rate drops. Either way, you win. Call us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com.
Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year fixed rate loans. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender. License in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply.
Welcome to On Trial. Starring Mark Radulich. Also starring Sean Comer. Hope you're ready, Hollywood, because you're on trial.
All rise. Court is now in session. The Honorable Judge Ito presiding. This is On Trial, and I'm your host, the mandated reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Radulich. Tonight, I'm in the role of prosecutor, and on the docket is Pan's Labyrinth. The accuser is a gal I work with. What a cutie. Her name is Kristen Johnson, and she said, I want you to see this film. And I said, why don't you go back to work, for Christ's sakes? We've got inmates to process. And she says, no, I'd rather talk to you about film. And I said, okay. She said, I want you to watch this. This was months ago. She was like, you got to see this movie, Pan's Labyrinth. It's the bee's knees. And I said, okay, well, I'm not watching anything unless I can somehow convert it into some sort of content for my podcast, because that's the kind of guy I am. And so here we are. I found a space for it on the docket here for the On Trial podcast, and here to defend a 2006 Cannes Film Festival release, winner of many numerous awards, Academy Awards, BAFTA Awards, Saturn Awards. This man's got the easy job tonight. He's your defense attorney. He's Sean Comer, and you're not. Hello, Sean. How are you?
Greetings, everyone. I'm Sean. You're not. You're Johnny Cochran for the evening to our apparent Honorable Judge Ito. Thank you for joining us, in my case, from the brand new Fortress of Seanitude. I'm living back in Kansas City again for the first time in... fuck me sideways. 8 years. Good to be home. I've been settling into my new digs, but it's nice to have a podcast on the docket again. And what a show we've got tonight. Mark, my condolences. You really did bite the bullet on the hard one this evening.
This is one of those where, if this were real life, the client came in, put down the money, and said, I'm going to need you to prosecute this case. And I took the case before looking at what it was. Like, oh, Christ, you murdered a school bus full of children. All right.
Wait. How many prosecutors do you know who accept cases based on people walking in and just plunking down big baskets? How does Florida law work?
Not well, I'll tell you that much.
Is there something about the Florida judicial system I'm not aware of? aside from plenty.
No, it the Florida judicial system is a mystery wrapped in a nutshell and wrapped in an enigma, wrapped in the funny pages.
I can see why you love it so.
Indeed. All right, I hear you've got notes. Notes about Pan's Labyrinth. Hit it, Johnny.
I got just a few. So, as a child, director extraordinaire Guillermo del Toro was beset by a recurring series of lucid dreams. In these, as he once told Charlie Rose, he would wake up every midnight on cue, and this fawn would step out from behind a grandfather clock. It was originally a your sort of traditional half-goat, half-man being beautiful, downright majestic. But as they progressed, it sort of evolved into this goat-faced being composed of a tangle of moss, vines, earth, tree bark, and he became mysterious, enigmatic, and completely devoid of, or not completely, but mostly devoid of trustworthiness. Many, many moons later, Del Toro would, as an adult, would travel around with these notebooks packed with ideas, drawings, doodles, plot concepts, what have you, about 20 years worth of these writings. And then at one point during a production, he happened to misplace one of them in a London taxi, which was later returned to him. From that notebook, he presented a story to a writer friend originally about a pregnant woman who falls in love with a fawn. And about a year and a half before filming, Del Toro relayed this experience to writer Sergi Lopez, and Lopez would say that for 2.5 hours he explained to me all the movie, but with all the details, it was incredible. And when he finished, I said, You have a script? He said, no, nothing is written. So this was all just right off the top of his head, just right off his knot. And what we ultimately got was this fantastical fable of war and mythicism set during the summer of 1944, 5 years after the Spanish Civil War, during the early Francoist period in Spain, during the conflict between the fascists and the communists. It's a story that Del Toro has said it has its religious influences. Del Toro himself calls it, quote, a truly profane film, a layman's riff on Catholic dogma. And, you know, most notably the famous scene with the Pale Man, the one with eyes on his hands, was intended as a particular riff on the church, particularly because of the Pale Man preferring children over this opulent feast that's set out right in front of him. And what resulted was also something of an informal sequel to Del Toro's earlier film, The Devil's Backbone, including cameo appearances by that film's two protagonists, Fernando Tielve and Inigo Garces, as unarmed guerrilla soldiers in Pan's Labyrinth. But you know, it takes its influences from, I mean, the most obvious one pretty much right from the start. You can tell right from about the first 15 minutes of the movie, the writings of Lewis Carroll, the Alice books, Jorge Luis Borges's Ficciones, Arthur Machen's The Great God Pan and the White People, Lord Dunsany's The Blessing of Pan, Algernon Blackwood's Pan's Garden, and the works of Francisco Goya. So very strongly influenced. It's a feast for the eyes, just gripping as a whole, although it kind of takes a little bit for its to some often seemingly unconnected plot threads to coalesce. And when it released in 2006, it was not what you would call a spectacular box office success. On a budget of $19 million, it did $83.3 million. So you could say it's possibly one of the least successful movies we've put under the microscope, at least commercially. It was an absolute critical darling, though. In particular, it won 3 out of the 5 Academy Awards for which it was nominated: Best Cinematography, Best Production Design, and Best Makeup. That's 3 out of the 6, because it was also nominated for Best Foreign Language Film, Best Original Screenplay, and Best Original Score. As Mark referenced, it won 3 BAFTA Awards for Best Makeup and Hair, Best Costume Design, and Best Film Not in the English Language. Del Toro was nominated for Best Foreign Language Film at the Golden Globe Awards. Arguably, its greatest success might have very well been at the Goya Awards, where it was nominated for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 awards, and won 5 for Best New Actress, Ivana Baquero, Best Makeup and Hairstyles, Best Editing, and Best Sound and Best Special Effects. So what we have here is something that people who have seen it absolutely adore. Critics were absolutely fanatical about it. It's just that, well, by all indications, not that many people saw it. So, Mark, are we good to go onward and put it on track?
I was waiting for you to conclude. If you're done, yeah, we'll. Yeah, if you're done with your notes, then all right. Let's do a quick plot synopsis, and then let's jump right into this. This is not going to be one of our lengthy episodes. I'll just warn people ahead of time. Now that I've said that, we'll be on here for about 10 hours, but. Basically, the plot of this thing is it takes place in 1944. Franco is Spain. Our protagonist is Ophelia. She's a young girl coming to live with Captain Vidal, who is her new stepfather. She's traveling with her pregnant mother, who is sick. Over the course of being there, she comes across a fairy. The fairy leads her to an ancient stone labyrinth. The film shifts between a couple of trips into this labyrinth that she makes, and the rest of it being taking place on this base, this castle where the captain and his army is at. There's rebels that they're hunting down. Without just reading straight from the Wikipedia, you'll have to excuse me. The basic details are she goes into the labyrinth once. She gets this root to help her mom deal with the pregnancy. It actually starts to help. However, it's found out, and the captain takes the root and throws it in the fire. The mom ends up getting sick. She ends up giving birth to the baby boy, but dies in childbirth. Meanwhile, there's a second trip into the labyrinth where she is told, you know, don't eat anything at the Pale Man's table. She, of course, eats 2 grapes. The Pale Man then gets up, eats a couple of the fairies, like bites their heads off, and chases her out of there. And she's told by Fawn she cannot go back. Later on, as their captain is dealing with more of the rebel issue, and we have a mole in the works, a woman who works in the kitchen, Mercedes. She's actually a traitor. As we're dealing with that, the Fawn says to Ophelia, hey, we're going to give you one more shot here, but you got to steal your brother and bring him to the labyrinth, and if you allow us to take just a drop of blood, you'll be able to return to the underworld, where you are in fact a princess. She doesn't want to do it. She ends up getting shot by her father, her stepfather, and she dies. But because of the noble sacrifice, she is able to reclaim her throne as Princess of the Underworld. Meanwhile, Mercedes and the Rebels end up cornering the captain and believe they shoot him in the end, as I recall. Yeah, shoots and kills him. And takes the sun. And that's pretty much the movie. There's a lot more detail to it than that, but those are the basic points. Look, let's get right to this, okay? Pan's Labyrinth. Or, what if somebody thought Alice in Wonderland just wasn't depressing enough and wanted to have a go at making a movie that's, you know, that's as gross and depressing as humanly possible, okay? I've been watching the Nerd Crew internet shorts from Red Letter Media, specifically the ones that were dealing with Rogue One, and there's a comment they made about it that reminds me of this movie. They're like, you know, Rogue One, which they also described as Star Wars fan fiction, the highest quality Star Wars fan fiction they'd ever seen. But they made more related to this movie, they made a specific comment of, you know, what if somebody took a children's fantasy and made it a gritty war movie so that as an adult they could justify, you know, liking and appreciating it, because they can't justify liking and appreciating a child's fairy tale. And that's what I was thinking about while I was watching this. I was also thinking, who the hell is this for? You know, as I read about it and researched it, the term fairy tale keeps coming up. And yeah, you know, some of our most famous fairy tales are pretty grim. Grimm's fairy tales, get it? Pretty violent stuff. You know, certainly the actual story of Cinderella and what happens to her, not the Disney version. Pretty violent stuff. Snow White, same thing. But most people associate fairy tales with, you know, brighter and happier than what this movie gives us. This feels like, and credit to Guillermo del Toro, you have a vision, you're blessed enough to carry out that vision and make a film, and the film makes money. I don't take away his success. In any of my criticism, I'm not going to say that this is a bad movie or that he doesn't deserve the credit that he gets for it, because he does. I can appreciate it on that level. However, don't tell me this is a don't tell me this is a fairy tale meant for children and then show me what this movie is, which 90% of it, first of all, doesn't take place in the labyrinth, okay? Like when I was pitched this movie to review it on this show, to watch it and review it. They're challenged, really. And the movie is called Pan's Labyrinth. I assume most of it's going to take place in the labyrinth. I assume, and maybe this is my fault, I'm going to be taken to a place in the far away, wonderful journey. You know, I expected David Bowie in his huge penis and tight pants to be greeting me at the door and taking me to a far away place. That's what I was expecting. Dance. Magic dance. That's what I wanted to see. The actual labyrinth. And instead, I got 90% a war picture where we see people being shot in the head. We see the captain's face being cut like the Joker. Mercedes almost gets executed herself, you know, until she gets all stabby. I mean, I've been known to show my kids things they probably shouldn't see. Again, you can check out previous podcasts where I talked about sitting down and watching The Orville with my kids to my shock and horror. It's the one where Bordis is addicted to porn. Oops. But not one of my best moves. But I would much rather show them The Orville or Family Guy than I would this movie. This is just, you know, if you like grim, if you like the horror aesthetic, this is very successful. But boy, was this made for a niche audience. And I can't get over the fact that it's called Pan's Labyrinth, and I feel like it's a bait-and-switch job. 90% of it takes place in, you know, in the real world, dealing with the captain and all of his violence. or the mom and her slowly but surely dying in her in the bed. I'm not going to belabor the point. I'm sure Sean has a wild and woolly defense of this. Again, it won a lot of awards. This is exactly the kind of movie that critics just do cartwheels over. And good on them. You know, I certainly can respect a well-made picture and it deserving all the awards that it gets. And this isn't about, you know, as Robert Winfrey likes to joke, you know, like, oh, there weren't any explosions, so I didn't like it. Look, there was a period of time where the indie flick Osama was one of my favorite movies. I'm going to talk about subtitles. Subtitles in the Afghan language, folks. Go check it out if you can find a copy of Osama. Good flick. So that's certainly not the issue here. The issue is there's niche, then there's this. And if you know, and as Jim Cornette would say, if this is the kind of thing people like, you know, then you know that's the kind of thing people like, and that's fine. But I'm not them peoples. Your witness, sir.
It bears noting that Guillermo del Toro has never really specifically said whether or not the mythical world in the movie was truly real or just a figment of Ophelia's imagination. However, despite the fact that he has said that it's meant to be somewhat ambiguous and that people should try to read into it whatever they want to lend it their own personal substance, he has said that there are definitely hints in the movie that strongly suggest that, yeah, it really was all real. And that's a big part of the beauty of it, is the fact that, well, nobody ever said this was intended for children. In fact, quite the obvious. It's an honest reflection on escapism from a terrible reality and just how far you can ever really entirely get away. It's a search for wonder in a world shredded by war and the very worst realities of human nature. It's beautifully ambiguous, but it contains a wonderful mirror juxtaposition of the mundane with the magical. At one point, Ophelia must voyage into a tree in order to convince a toad to stop destroying everything around it. In order to do that, she has to feed it some magic stones so that it will belch up a big puddle of queso containing a necessary magical key. Back in the real world, a stolen real key allows the revolutionaries to infiltrate a secret supply bunker. One which has been maintained by the fascists, who are also growing fat while pillaging and poisoning everything around them. Later, when Ophelia must infiltrate the feast of the Pale Man, her greed becomes a ruin. She goes in with seeming ease, is all set to make good her escape, but makes one fatal error, and it costs her the lives of two of her compatriots as the Pale Man attacks. Back up in the real world, the guerrilla assault on the bunker is blundered because using the key means that the captain is quickly able to deduce that since it wasn't forced, that must have meant that someone had the key, and from there it's only a matter of time until he exacts his own revenge and takes several key characters' lives with him. That's kind of the beauty of it, is you're never sure if everything that's going on is just Ophelia's way of trying to make sense of everything that's going on around her, all of the utterly senseless, brutal, tragic violence, and if it's perhaps just her coping mechanism. There's even a certain way you could view way you could view her ultimate end, in that possibly her sacrificing herself rather than having seeing the blood of an innocent shed is her way of possibly dying with a certain degree of peace. Because, after all, she certainly hasn't had any throughout the rest of the movie. The fact is, when I generally think of Del Toro, the first thing I think of is damn certainly not subtext. His movies are typically utter feasts for the eyes. They are absolute, wondrous, mesmerizing spectacle. As much as I love this, my favorites are always going to be probably a three-way tie between Blade 2 and the first two Hellboy movies, for just that very reason. He has this way of blurring reality and fantasy, and leaving you equally gripped by both. And it's why this story could have only come from his utterly beautiful mind. I mean, yeah, I can see where the prosecution is coming from when he talks about not being sure who this movie was made for. It's kind of the Dark Crystal problem, if you will. When that came out, it was never really explicitly clear to whom that was supposed to appeal either, which was probably what made this a bit of a tricky sell in theaters. However, once you do sit down and give it a watch, and I admit it probably should not be shown to particularly young children, it's easy to see it as something that you could see and have it stick with you for the rest of your life. My one complaint about it would really be that it takes a little bit for sort of the connectedness of everything to come together in an easily discernible manner. You know, I have to admit, for a while there, I was watching this and thinking to myself, well, all well and good, but why aren't we in the labyrinth more often? Why are we spending all this time centered on this one little conflict of the Spanish Civil War? But when I got it, I got it, and I appreciated it. All in all, it really is a fairly tightly told tale, and in my opinion, a masterpiece of modern fantasy. It's epic, it's poetic, it's a slow descent into the underworld, and ultimately, in the end, when the true nature of the Fawn is revealed, you realize that, no, nothing ever really was quite as you expected it to be. I mean, I went into that part of the movie thinking for certain that he was going to be revealed to be some kind of villain, some deceiver, someone who was seeking to perhaps overthrow the overworld government and take over the human world. But no, as it turned out, he was the proctor of some kind of grand exam to determine whether the princess was worthy to return to her kingdom. I think it's kind of shameful that in its first 3 weeks at the box office in the U.S., this movie made only $5.4 million. As of March 1st, 2007, it had made $37 million, and fortunately rallied another $80 million worldwide to kind of bolster its meager total. In Spain alone, it made almost $12 million, and it currently ranks as the fourth highest domestically grossing foreign film in the United States. Yeah, that is correct. I had to kind of reread my wording there. Currently, in the United States, it ranks as the fourth highest domestic grossing foreign film of all time. And, of course, made back another $55 million from its DVD sales and rentals. So, yeah, initially box office flop, but a strong award showing and word of mouth more than did it the justice that it deserved. Yours to finish up.
Let me say this. I understand the argument, and I certainly understand the intent of the film, that this is both escapism for the audience as it is with Ophelia. You know, Ophelia is in a situation she doesn't want to be in from the very start of the film. She did not want to recognize him as her stepfather. She did not want to go to the castle. You know, all the sort of typical for a child protagonist in these kinds of movies. You know, why do we need stepdad? And I get that. So there's this possibility that she is creating this underworld realm, and all of the labyrinth scenes are, you know, her imagination. Her sort of dealing with the trauma of her surroundings. That's fine. So then I have to question her sanity as well, because I don't know. Maybe it's just me, and maybe I'm not giving proper credit to the time in which this child is living in, or to the sort of stimuli that she has come across. But when I think about fantasy and I think about where would I rather be rather than my humdrum life, I'm probably not running afoul of a guy, of the Pale Man or even the Fawn. I keep coming back to this. You know, when Alice falls asleep and she travels to Wonderland, there are parts of Wonderland that are utterly fantastic. I mean, not done by. Not in any modern iteration of Alice in Wonderland. Oh gosh, what was the director's name? Tim Burton. Yeah, not in his interpretation of Alice in Wonderland, but normal people. Alice goes to a place of magic, a place of wonder, a place of color, a place where outside of the Jabberwocky there isn't a scary monster.
It's painfully obvious the prosecution has never played either of American McGee's Alice games.
Like I said, normal people.
Fucking nightmare. Normal people. Hot shot at gamers. Bite your tongue.
God damn it, Alice in Wonderland's a lovely story. People should stop ruining it by turning it into monsters left and right. Anyway, my point being that I feel like most kids, when they want to escape their surroundings, dream up the fantastic, not the monstrous. So it's a little hard for me to sort of, allow the movie to sort of hang its hat on this is where she went to.
Okay. My minor counterpoint to that, though. In a way, I can kind of see where it's coming from, because if you can take some of the actions of what you're seeing around you, and kind of attribute them to monsters, to otherworldly creatures, I can see how it would sort of help the denial of being forced to accept human beings are actually capable of some of this shit.
I see your point, and I would concede it, except for the fact that, I mean, if let's say, for example, and maybe this is more hitting you over the head with it, than
swing away
than the movie should, but if Ophelia is standing in front of the captain and he suddenly morphs into a monster, because that's what she sees, and that's how her brain is interpreting what's around her, that's one thing, and I get it, and I'm okay with it. That's not escapism, though. And to say the labyrinth is escapism, so you're escaping to a place that's equally or more horrifying? Again, I go to the Pale Man scene. It's a nice scene. You know, I get the symbolism and all of that, as it's attached to what's happening in the real world. I thought that was a finely made point. One I wish I had thought of, and I give you a lot of credit for it. But again, you escaped from one situation to another that's equally or more horrifying.
Well, I mean, again, though, it's It's kind of creating a scenario, and again, this is part of the wondrous ambiguity of this movie, is the fact that you can interpret it a number of ways.
See, I'm more willing to bet this is Guillermo sort of excising his traumas and his issues.
Well, see, and I mean, and one way you could kind of think of it is every day she sees these remorseless, vicious adults around her, armed to the teeth, no qualms about spilling the blood of their fellow men. She has no way to combat this, to stand against it. But on the other hand, you know, the other creatures, the Pale Man, the Toad, these are things she can seemingly figure out a way to outwit. If you're looking at it sort of that way. And in a strange way, yeah, maybe that does kind of make them just a little bit less scary.
I'll concede the point. And we'll end it with the gal asked me today. She's like, "What'd you think of the movie?" And look, it's a well-made movie. This is not one of those on trials where I could, you know, I could go on attacking the craft. If you had stuff that you had issue with and want to bring up now, that's fine. We'll quick get into some of this movie. There were craft issues, but other than I just don't feel like you spend enough time in the movie's namesake for to really make the whole experience worth it. Other than that, I mean, you know, the acting, the set pieces, all the things that go into making a movie, I thought were fine and deserving of the praise that they got. I think where the movie fell down for me, you know, I think the answer I gave her, and granted, this was sort of I don't have an hour to explain my thoughts, you know, was like, it was okay, it's not for me. So what real quick, what craft issues did you have with the movie?
Oh no, I'm sorry, I kept cutting you off. I apologize for that. I think you misunderstood. I was gonna say, if you had any craft issues with it, dude, I could let this go on for another hour, probably arguing anything you would come up with.
No, it's a very artfully made movie.
Yeah, as with just about everything Del Toro makes, it is absolutely delightful to watch. Carrie is slightly disagreeing with me.
I mean, it's no, don't get me wrong, it's no Porky's, but it's fine. And I think that's a great place to end the show. What do you think?
Well, fuck me running, Mark. I'm deeply sorry that it doesn't feature giant robots peeing on John Turturro for you.
That's not the best part of Transformers for me. No, the one that I like is Age of Ultron. That's the go-to one.
Age of Ultron. Which...
Not Age of Ultron. Shit, not Age of Ultron. Age of Extinction. Jesus, I'm tired.
I was going to say that. I briefly went, wait a fucking tick. No. Real talk, all pre-assigned roles for this debate aside, I absolutely loved this. I was glad I stopped and watched it. It's not the kind of popcorn flick that I think I could put on anytime I happen to feel like watching a movie. Carrie is once more indicating to me no way in hell she has any intention of probably ever again watching it all the way through. But I was glad I sat down and watched it, but now I want to eventually sit down and watch Hellboy and Hellboy 2 the Golden Army.
It's funny because the whole time I'm thinking this, I'm like, I'm a little shy about, you know, going into my usual rant about things, because this girlfriend's going to think, what kind of dullard, rockhead moron do you do this podcast with? And meanwhile, she's over there like, fuck Pan's Labyrinth. All right, now I feel better.
Oh, not in the least. We We have our movies that we both love, and I'm sure that as time goes on, we're going to come across those that one of us likes, and the other one just goes, yeah, no.
Well, we're going to go from the sublime to the absurd next month, as our next On Trial will be March 28th, and it'll be Scooby-Doo 2, Monsters Unleashed.
Okay, Carrie has volunteered to join in on that one.
Terrific. We're doing that because on Monday of that week, Jesse Starcher will be doing Scooby-Doo Apocalypse on Source Material. And in the middle of all that, we'll actually be looking at the Netflix biopic for Motley Crue, The Dirt, based on the autobiography written by all four members of Motley Crue. Well, five members if you count the guy that replaced Vince Neil. The Dirt. And then on that week, the Metal Hammer of Doom, we'll be looking at Motley Crue's greatest hit. So that'll be a lot of fun. That'll be the week I come back from my spring break cruise. So it'll be a good week to jump in there. As far as what other On Trials we're doing, like I said, March 28th is Scooby-Doo 2. Not quite as heavy as Pan's Labyrinth, but right up there. In April, we're actually going to take a break from On Trial, and we're going to do, as Sean mentioned, some of his favorite movies. We're going to do them as A Long Road to Ruin. We're going to bring that back this year. Hellboy, 2004 and 2008.
Hey, real quick, am I prosecuting or defending Scooby-Doo?
Prosecuting.
Fuck yeah.
I like to take all the hard cases, all the nonsense ones. So yeah, Long Road to Ruin for that. In May, we've got on the May 9th, we've got On Trial, The Three Musketeers, and A Long Road to Ruin for John Wick, the first two movies. So that's what's next up over the next couple of months. As for this week, real quick, we did not do, there was no Metal Hammer of Doom this week. One, I wasn't feeling up to it. Two, the new Bring Me the Horizon was just not our thing, and I didn't feel up to, you know, spending an hour trying to explain why. Look, I know, I get why some people would like it, but it's not my bag, nor Jesse Starcher's. Plus, I needed to watch Pan's Labyrinth, so we decided to axe it from the schedule. However, we do have Voltron Season 8. Robert Winfrey and I got into a great discussion for an hour discussing the final season of Voltron Legendary Defender on Netflix. And if you want to see two utterly confused comic book readers, check out the podcast for The Search for Ray Palmer on Source Material. As Jesse Starcher and I just throw our hands up in aggravation saying, I don't understand you, DC. Next week, a much easier task on hand, as we'll be looking at Punisher Max Volume 5, The Slavers, and we'll be doing a TV party for Punisher Season 2. And on the Metal Hammer of Doom, we'll be reviewing the new Beast in Black. All right, Sean, go ahead and do your plugs. Where are you twitching these days?
Well, I actually have got a little logistical reconfiguring that I've got to do before I can get back to streaming. Just getting moved into the new digs, so I'm still kind of getting used to my usual routine. I've got to figure out my actual streaming setup as far as time and getting a slightly bigger TV goes. I need a chair that I'll be able to sit in for about 2 or 3 hours at a time. I had been using my old exercise ball, but we have a vicious predator kitty in the house that I fear will eviscerate it if I even dare try to inflate it. So that is on momentary hiatus. However, when I come back in the not too distant future, my plan is to get right back to playing a whole lot of competitive Overwatch, preferably with my good buddy and Reaper extraordinaire Raven. Playing a whole lot of Dead by Daylight now that I'm actually starting to get my survivor skills back. And getting back to single-player gaming, starting with finishing Batman Arkham Knight and Marvel Spider-Man. If you want to keep up on when I am going to be streaming again, which hopefully will be sometime within the next month or two. Follow me on Twitter at Comer Codex. Now that I'm poking my head out of my little hidey hole again, I will, you know, be getting back to that soon, because I have missed showing everybody just how much I am capable of sucking at video games in front of an audience. And yeah, who knows? Maybe I'll even be able to drag some guests along with me.
All right, folks. Court is now in recess. We hope you'll join us again soon. For Sean, I'm your mandated reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Radulich. This has been On Trial, and we look forward to offending you in the future. Have a good night.
I'm Jay Farner, CEO of Quicken Loans, America's premier home purchase lender. We've created a new way to protect you from unpredictable interest rates. Our exclusive Rate Shield approval. First, we lock your interest rate for up to 90 days. Then, if rates go up, your rate stays locked. But if rates go down, your rate drops. Either way, you win. Call us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com.
Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year fixed-rate loans. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply.